Thanks for asking me. I'm very flattered. I guess the best measure of my gratitude for being asked is that between 10:30 on Saturday morning, when college game day starts, and sometime after midnight on Saturdays, it's virtually impossible to get me out of the house. So I do have someone in the back who'll be flashing scores for me. I am flattered to be here. I am Maxine, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. I'll probably run a little bit over 30 minutes, but since the moon is full, please feel free to go to the bathroom, get coffee, scratch, you know, whatever. The southern humorist Florence King refers to a southern woman who went to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said to her, "Tell me something about yourself." And she said, "Well, my great-grandfather..." And so, being a southerner, I must begin my story with my great-grandfather's story. For my great-grandfather was a teacher, and he was an alcoholic. He made a... And I will be laid to rest in the family cemetery with my great-grandparents, my grandparents, my parents. I'll be laid to rest between my father, Mac, and my great-great-uncle, Mac, who was a common ancestor of my parents. And great-great-uncle Mac was said to drink a half pint of whiskey every morning before breakfast, and when it spit in the fire, it flamed blue. So I used to say I'm descended from a long line of people who love their dram. And when you're an only child, you tend to identify yourself with your elders, right? Because you don't have siblings to identify with. So I derive my identity from the stories I heard of my rather outrageous relatives. My parents were cousins, so it was sort of a blended family. I inherited all the bad genes from them. And so the outrageous stories about my cousin Bailey, Daddy's cousin, who would drive in his Model T under the sheds on the streets with his mother insisted on going with him because he was drunk. Then ride under the shed and said, "Bailey, Bailey, we'll all be killed." And but now my great-uncle Mac was an adult child of an alcoholic. He was never known to laugh out loud. I never heard my father Mac laugh out loud. He always went to bed at 9 o'clock. By the time he was in his 20s, he had earned enough money in cotton futures to send all of his nieces and nephews to school to be teachers. And when my father was 19, he started teaching in the same one teacher school where his grandfather had taught. But all of them were temperamentally unsuited to teaching. One of an old man who used to plow near that one teacher school would say he could remember hearing my great grandfather shouting at the children. And then my great uncle on the other side, and Uncle Aretas, he taught as a young man, and he got mad with the students at that little one teacher school, whipped every one of them, including his little sisters. And when he went home, his father whipped him, and he left and went to Savannah. And so there are all manner of outrageous stories. There are some sobering stories, too. I'm going to tell a story before I get into my own story. I'm going to tell a story I told the first time I told my story at the Dogwood Club, probably 22 or 3 years ago. My father's youngest sister was very dear to me, and my father's oldest brother died at 41 of diabetes. His next brother died at 48 of alcoholism. His third brother was a lifelong alcoholic. He had 3 sisters, and then his the 2 younger brothers, my father and his brother Braxton, were not alcoholics, though their only children were, I and my cousin Bailey. And I told this story. Bailey came down to Aunt Martha's one Friday afternoon at night in the rain, and his wife was driving, and he had evidently been drinking. Aunt Martha, motivated partly by being a Baptist and partly knowing the tragedies in our life of alcoholism, said, "I'm going to change my will." There he was in the rain with his, and his children in there and him drinking. And we were talking, and he was saying how much his oldest son, Bailey, who was the by that time the fifth generation Bailey in the family. I'm in the fourth generation of Max, and there's a fifth and sixth. And there are also six generations of Aretuses, too, and lots of alcoholism. Anyhow, Mac was about, he was about four, three or four, and his brother Bailey was about six in the first grade. And they were saying, well, Bailey took a math test, 100 questions. He finished it in 5 minutes and made 100. And his brother Mac said, you know, Aunt Maxine, he worried and worried. He studied and studied long after I was asleep. And I thought, mm-hmm, that's that is the typical alcoholic and the typical adult child of an alcoholic. And today, Bailey is finishing up his residency in medical school, and Mac has dropped out of college. I don't know quite why, but nevertheless, I have to say that first and foremost, alcoholism is a disease of the family, and second, it is the disease of the personality. Not my intake of alcohol, but my expression of my personality has been the great burden, not only of my life, but upon other people as well. When my mother would get really, mother hated Daddy's family, and the favor was returned, because she was a poor relation, and they, you know, and when she would get really exasperated with me, say, well, you're just a Thompson. And I remember at about 8 or 9, looking at my arms, thinking of the blood flowing through my veins, knowing that blood determined in some way personality, and I said, well, I'm just a it's in my blood. I'm just like that. And my Aunt Essie, who was a genealogist, used to always get mad with him. Mother, sister get mad with him and say, you just got bad blood from the joiners. You just got bad blood. What I had was alcoholic blood. And it takes, they say, 10 years to make an alcoholic. So I'll talk to you about the first 12 years of my life and of the beginning of the molding of my personality. Hillary Clinton says it takes a village to raise a child. I never understood that very well until I contemplated that my childhood was a tribal childhood. I did not spend much time in direct interaction with my parents. I have very little memory of direct interaction with my parents, but I have a sort of a global memory of aunts, uncles, cousins of many degrees. I had a much older cousin named Precious, Cousin Precious, who had a glass eye. It sort of fixed it, you know, and you always had to speak to your cousins. Your distant cousin will I call Cousin Kathleen. And then there was Cousin Precious and Cousin Nanny. I say, Cousin, hello, Cousin Precious. She looked at me and says, I'm Mac's daughter. Oh, Mac's daughter. And she's going, but you always had to speak to your cousin, and you just had these tons of cousins. Since my family had taught in that county since the 1850s, my parents and aunts and uncles had taught a good portion of the families in the county. So we knew everybody. And my parents were very much beloved and are to this day by people who've grown older now, but who taught them and who wielded the hickory stick with great fervor. And it was a wonderful childhood. My father's two sisters, Martha and Nellie, they had no children. Aunt Nellie didn't marry until she was later. And in the family, there's always one woman in the family that sort of holds things together. My great aunt Lucy lived with her three old bachelor brothers and rode up Pike's Peak on a mule in 1907 and so forth. And Aunt Nellie just held everything. She got all the alcoholic brothers out of trouble. And then Aunt Martha and her husband, Ed, had no children. So I had lots and lots. Then Aunt Polly and Uncle Rita lost their only child at 16 from diabetes. And so I had just troops of childless aunts and uncles who paid a lot of attention to me. I had a rather Huck Finn childhood. We were free to roam about in those days. You know, I learned how to shoot a BB gun by the time I was 7, 22 by the time I was 10. You learn how to crack a whip. You learn how to make a noose. You learn how to throw a knife. Those were But you also learn all the lady things, too, you see. But living in the country, the South in the late 30s and the 40s was a pretty violent place, and still is if you go to certain places. It was also open season on little girls. I did not realize till I was a couple of years sober that I had been pretty roundly abused by a variety of family members and neighbors as a child. But it was not something you went crying about. That's just things that happened. So, and there is no denying that they happened with consequences as well. But in any case, I was not a very assertive child. I was pretty and I was smart, but I was not very assertive. And we moved around a lot. By the time my parents bought their first home when I was age 15, we had lived in 15 different houses. I went to four or five different schools as a child and in the schools where my parents taught. My childhood ended when I was 11 years old, and we moved to Columbus, where my parents were in a larger school system, and great stresses descended upon them. I will say of my parents, we always talk about an unhappy child and what our parents did to us. My parents, the only thing my parents did to me was what they did not do for themselves. Okay? They had a large impersonal school system to deal with. There were stresses in their marriage because my father, who was a very handsome and charming man, was teaching in a bevy of more sophisticated city women who very much appreciated him as he appreciated them. My mother was very jealous. And they also had to go back to school and finish their bachelor's degrees and their master's degrees because they kept upping the ante on teachers' certificates then. And so by the time I was 12, I had suffered a series of losses. When I was 8, we moved, and I had to leave behind my doll, Jodine. When I was 9, we moved, and I had to leave behind my dog, Stubby. When I was 11, we moved, and I had to leave my piano. And when I was 12, my Aunt Nellie married, and she had been my mainstay. So I was left without my home base and with only an air rifle and a ukulele left. So, in any case, I drank. Mother and Daddy always kept a pint of whiskey for medicinal purposes. They did not drink. One time Uncle Rita came and spent the night with us, and I was making his bed the next morning, so he had left an empty pint of whiskey, and I picked up and drained it. And so thereafter, they would not keep liquor in the house because they discovered me nipping along on that whiskey. They would not keep liquor in the house, and Mother was very careful never to let me go see any family who drank and kept me away from drinking. So I was an alcoholic already, and I wanted the magic that would make the pain go away. So I had to set about creating a new self for myself. And it came into play that I suffered from the disease of defiance. Now, my disease of defiance was never breaking the rules. My disease of defiance was I will meet and excel the rules so you can't touch me. You know, I'll pass your test. You know, I'll obey your rules. I'll be above and apart from discipline. That was always my modus operandi. I always felt that I could beat the odds. And I tell you what, that has gotten me in more trouble than anything I can think of. But I became the star of the family. I became the star who went out into the world to an exclusive high school, who was Miss Everything. And I read many biographies. I was never exposed to a public library until I was 11. Before then, I had just read what was around the house. Uncle Ed's, Aunt Martha's husband was a World War I veteran, so my favorite book was from before I went to school was Pictorial History of the Great War. Then I read Popular Mechanics, the American Legion magazine, The Great Teacher, The Progressive Farmer, and Journal of the Exceptional Child. You had to read what you had. We didn't have a daily paper. We had a weekly paper, but not a daily paper. And so my parents read to me, but sometimes we lived in a house where they had no electric lights. So they'd have to study their lessons at night, and I'd just sit on the arm of that chair, and they would read me whatever they were preparing the lesson, algebra, world history, grammar, whatever. They would just read to me whatever they happened to be reading. So I was always very, very verbal. I remember seeing the earliest electric lights, and I'd say, what does it say? Not how it works, but what does it say? Because to me, all knowledge was verbal, and that remained so. Have no head for figures, as Laura can tell you. But in any case, I was also, alcoholism is the disease of isolation. I had spent a great deal of time alone. Only 2 years in my life, up to age 15, did I live in a town where there were kids my age. I'd spent the first 4 years in Andersonville, Georgia, where I was the only child in town, the only baby child in town. Now, also, before age 5, learned about and became interested in the Civil War, which has been a lifelong interest of mine. So another thing that happened to me when I got into life, I read a lot of biographies. In my junior year in college, in high school, I set myself the task of reading only biography that year. And I was very much inspired, I must say, by the biography of Robert E. Lee. Lee was the beau ideal of manhood and chivalry and principle and honor and so forth. And I have to say that that has been a very important factor in my life. I'm not a fire-breathing secessionist or anything of that sort, but there were certain ideals out of the Civil War that had a great impact upon me. Mother used to lie in wait for the people at Andersonville Cemetery. Her great-grandfather had been a guard there. And lie in wait for Yankees and refit the war, you know. But while I waited in Sweetwater Creek. But another thing that happened when I started to, when Mother and Daddy started back to school was that for the first time, he needed a secretary, and there was no budget for it. So I, from age 11 till I went to college, I did all of his secretary work, all his typing for him. They both, from the time I was 12 until I was 21, one or both of them were going to school on Thursday, alternate Thursday nights or alternate Saturdays to Auburn. And we spent the summers, two or three summers in Auburn. And I did preliminary bibliographies for them in the library. I attended class with them, and I typed all their term papers. I had audited 3 years of college before I went to college. In fact, some of us now went to Oglethorpe, and I had the run of the campus. At Oglethorpe, I studied German, American literature, and typing at age 9. And, there are chimes in the tower at Oglethorpe. I found the door that led to the keyboard for the chimes. And I was caught at it, but I had fun until they wondered, what is chopsticks doing? So anyhow, so it took, but let me say that primary in my life then and until always, I was very religious. Aunt Nellie was a Primitive Baptist. I went to hear endless sermons with her. My mother was a Baptist. I went to church with her. My father was Methodist. And I was baptized as Methodist at age 10. The Methodists were somewhat more dignified than the shouting Baptist. And so that appealed to me. And so I was always very religious, and especially religious when I was all cut loose and by myself when we moved to a city. And religion really was my mainstay. Then I went to college. And I had been a rather fearful person, but I adopted the motto, do the thing you fear. And I did. I was terrified of going up on the fourth floor, down all those stairs. I disciplined myself till I could slide down on that one pipe banister with my foot hooked onto the other banister. And I just would not let myself be afraid. I would walk the little rampart on the top of the fourth floor roof, and I simply would not allow myself to be afraid. And so in college, I was also a high achiever, but I was a very serious student not in the things that they were required, but in other things like philosophy, Emerson, Plato, a lot of serious reading and a great deal of serious writing. I had the opportunity to do a lot of writing, and also I was always a singer. I sang and played the ukulele for people, and I sang in choirs, and I came from a very musical family. But one of the things, I got to backtrack a minute and say that at age 16, I had pneumonia and was very run down. And so the doctor said to Mother, what you need to do is get a tablespoon or two of alcohol and beat it up with an egg and some sugar and milk. Give that to Maxine every night at bedtime. Well, honey, I was like a dog waiting for me. So that little toddy for the body was certainly welcome. And I did not drink in college. It was a very strict school. I'm telling you what. You don't know about discipline and rules until you've been to college in Methodist school in the 50s. But I was an Al-Anon in college. I served 2 years on the honor committee and 2 years on the social, for 3 years on the social honor committee. You know, I carried the key to the dorm and saw that everybody behaved. And I always said I'd make a good nun or a good Nazi, but nevertheless. Nevertheless, when I, at 22, I graduated from college. I got my degree about noon, and by 1 o'clock, I was barefoot in Bermuda shorts in the best restaurant in Montgomery ordering a whiskey sour. By golly, I was let loose. And the next day, I was drunk on the beach at Panama City, you know, the Redneck Riviera, where Alabama people go and party. Then I went to graduate school, and I had been through college sort of semi-engaged to my high school sweetheart who was at Georgia Tech, you know, who was majoring in engineering, who was a genius. Boy, geniuses are very difficult. In any case, I had always assumed that I would major in the liberal arts, you know, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And but he made a fatal mistake. Our senior year, after the year I graduated, he went to Venezuela for a year to work for Schlumberger. And I had nothing to do but go to graduate school at Auburn. And I learned what it was to go to class in a designer suit and heels and hose and a blouse and stand up and be a professor and, you know, date more sophisticated people. And I must tell you my first drunk story. One of my professors invited all the history graduate students to his house for tea. And it was a Sunday afternoon. Of course, in those days, you wore hat and glove, matching shoes and bag. So I had a hat that had a kind of rolled brim, and it had a veil, and the veil kept bothering me. So, you know, after 5 o'clock, you didn't wear a hat. You wore something called an after five hat or a whimsy, but you didn't wear it. So I got a little tiddly on Sherry, and at 5:15 I said, it's after five, I'm taking off my hat. So that was my drunk story. And you know, when I went back to Auburn to get my doctorate 6 years later, they were still telling that story. See, it was enough that you drank. You didn't have to whore around and get DUIs. It was enough that you drank. And if you smoked, that compounded the felony. Even old ladies who dipped snuff thought it was scandalous that I smoked. So in any case, then I went through my marriage stage. I did marry my high school sweetheart. And it is strange the effect marriage has on me, how it makes them change personality. he was in graduate school at Tech. We had a little apartment over on North Morningside Drive. Just as you take a ride, they had a little garage apartment, studio apartment. And I typed his term papers, and I thought, now wait a second. You know, I didn't have a car. He went off to class, and there I was. And I thought, And then I said, well, I want to work. He says, you'll never work a day in your life. I'm going to keep you barefoot and pregnant. I says, oh, no, you're not. So he flunked out of graduate school and moved to my parents' home and sort of lay around drinking beer, you know, sending out resumes. And finally, my mother said, called his mother and said, now, look, either he gets a job or he has to leave my house. So mother packed up his goods, and his mother came and got him. And he wouldn't go to church. I always relied on church. See, your higher power triangulates whatever's happening between people. If you just go to church and let that higher power be in your life, then things will be all right. I tried to do that with my parents. I tried to do that with my first husband. I tried to do that with my second husband. Because I always looked upon the church as being the ultimate answer, the safe place where daddy never got mad and mother never cried, you know. Nobody's going to act ugly at church. So in any case, we divorced. Then I went to University of Maryland and got a job in one of the finest junior colleges in the country without an interview. Got a job without an interview. And also, I met the man of my dreams. He was a Civil War scholar. That's how I know. I was doing some research on the Civil War. I'd written my master's thesis on the Civil War. And so he was handsome. He was charming. He was from a very distinguished family. He had an endowed chair at a small college in Iowa. He was an Episcopalian. And so I married my dream man and awoke to my nightmare. You know, it was like waking up in Paris Island with your own private drill sergeant. I know that I did a lot to provoke you. I know that I did. In fact, it's the only time in my life I've ever had to be passive aggressive. You know, I'm not a weak woman. I don't have to be passive aggressive. But I'm telling you, I made it a fine and practiced art. And I also started smoking again and started drinking again. And to both those husbands, and I wrote, setting aside for the moment that he was a psychopath, I wrote him an amend. Some years ago, he wrote me to ask me about some divorce papers, and I wrote him back. And I made him an amends, because I was an alcoholic, and I did flirt scandalously with his best friend. But I thought, this is not, the thing about amends, this is not about them. This is about you. You know, I owe this man really struck a blow to my life. Well, my decision to marry him really did. But an amends is about ye, not about them. And I have more recently made an amends to my first husband. I thought that I had given him enough grief without interfering in his life, you know, so long as it doesn't cause harm to him or others. So I did write him following our 50th college reunion. And he wrote back and said that, you know, everything was okay. Then he said, write and tell me about your travels. So I wrote him a 10-page letter about the 33 countries I had visited in the past 13 years and never heard anything back from him. Because I have become everything that he did not want me to be. Everything he did not want me to be. I'm sorry. That's just how it was. So after getting married and unmarried, where should I go but back to graduate school? I had to get my union card. I had to get my doctorate to teach. And if you're a drunk, the place to be is in graduate school in the liberal arts. If you're a drunk, the thing to do is to teach the liberal arts in college. You wander into class, you spend 50 minutes talking off the top of your head about whether Emily Dickinson was queer, and then you might mark a few papers, you know, and then it's all right, you know. I could never, ever have worked an eight-hour job. I just never could have worked. I couldn't have survived. I worked an eight-hour job at Sears, receiving room in high school, and I always threatened to go back to the only good job I ever had. But in any case, but once again, I had become an Episcopalian, been confirmed as an Episcopalian when I was in graduate school the first time, and I remained very active in the church, in the choir, church women, altar guild. And I was, again, very reliant upon religion. After graduate school, I got my first big job, and I went to work and play on a grand scale, making a good salary, sharing a very large mansion on a very fine street in a very small town. You could lose 75 people in that house at a party, and sometimes did. But in any case, I made the mistake of going to the school where my mother had been president of her senior class, and where my department chairman had been a classmate of my father's. And I walked in the door, and she said, "This young woman is a threat to me." And I'm telling you what, if your schedule is an 8 o'clock class, a 4 o'clock class, and a 7 to 9:30 class twice a week, you know your boss doesn't like you. It's in for you. And I was making a lot of money, and so I just bottomed. I bottomed. I just lost it in class one day. I don't know whether I was hungover. I'd had two sweet rolls and a cup of coffee for breakfast, and this was, you know, a generation of people have had their heads nipped off at between 11 and 12 by my family who had low blood sugar. So that time it went too far. And I just had to be carried out to the booby hatch on a stretcher. I went to my internist, and I said, "Am I an alcoholic or diabetic?" He said, "Well, I'll give you a blood test." because I was calling my partner, "Give me a blood test," it was normal. Then I went to my psychiatrist, and I says, "Am I an alcoholic?" He says, "Well, I tell you, you're obsessive compulsive." He says, "All professionals are more compulsive than an average of the population, but you are more compulsive than an average of professionals. But you have a high degree of reality application." Well, at that point, I was hearing messages to me out of the television. My reality application was on a slippery slope. So they put me in the hospital and filled me with Thorazine and Melaril. And I wrote my dissertation on 1,500 milligrams of Thorazine a day. Talk about leaden prose. It did not sing in soul, I'll have to tell you that. So I stayed at home a year writing my dissertation. And then I got my second big job just by the merest chance. Someone left Georgia Tech, and I had partied with the Tech faculty. And they say, "Well, how did you get your job?" I said, "I wore white gloves to my interview." And I did. I wore white gloves. Black piqué dress with a white piqué collar. Black patent accessories and white gloves with left glove in hand. And that appealed to this man. And also, he had been very charmed by my ability to imitate the crooner Gene Austin in singing Ramona. And so he thought I held my liquor well, which is an important thing in academia. So in any case, I got this job. But I tell you what, I had gone from the belle of the ball to a 200-pound Thorazine zombie almost overnight. I did not know until I got in the program some years later when Jackie V told me that a paranoia and fear are side effects of Thorazine. Mother and Daddy put me in a basket and left me at the Darlington. Everybody starts in Atlanta at the Darlington, you know. And I was afraid to leave my apartment. I would go to class in stark terror. It took me about 4 years to get over that stark terror, but I forced myself to do it. I defied the odds. I was in the booby hatch with a neighbor of mine. She was also drinking. My family had been friends for years. You know, she went home and spent the rest of her life at home on drugs. And finally, when her mother went to the nursing home, she had to go to the nursing home with her. There but for the grace of God. Then they passed a rule that you had to publish to get tenure. So I lost 60 pounds, published 17 items in 3 years, got tenure, bought a home, got a car, began to drink. What else do you do when you're successful? I've had this long history of reaching some achievement and drinking it away. Reaching an achievement, drinking it away. And indeed, I did. It took me from 1976 to... It took me 3 years to destroy what I had gained. I kept my job, of course. I had tenure. Why else do you teach in college? You know, those who can do, those who can't teach, those who won't have tenure. So finally, I went to AA, March the 15th, 1970, and went out to Napa. And I dressed up to go. Like, I said, are you sure this is your first meeting? And I said, yes. So in any case, you know, you have to soldier on. So in any case, I lasted 2 weeks and then went to a convention to make 4 speeches in Raleigh. And what do you think I did the night before I had to make 4 speeches the next day? Yes. I only had like 2 glasses of rosé, but it was enough that I had fallen off the wagon. Then a good friend of mine who lived in Raleigh, a brigadier general in the Salvation Army, asked me home with her and her sister. Now, her sister drank and said, would you like a drink? Oh, yes, I'll have a drink. And she fixed me a bourbon and water, and I thought, what kind of person will lie to the dearest, sweetest, most saintly woman you know? You know, what kind of person are you? So I got on the plane, and I had a blackjack and water, and the stewardess, cabin attendant, complimented me on my good taste and said many people drink blackjack and coke, and I would never do that, blah, blah, blah. And so then I came in the program again May 9th, 1979. I had quit drinking May 6th, 1979. And Justine and Barbara were at my first meeting and have been there for me when I had heart surgery at George Baptist, when my mother died at George Baptist. Mother was at George Baptist when my aunt died at George Baptist. So they have certainly been with me by precept and example all these years. So don't expect a shower of rose petals and a swell of organ music that finally I got into AA, because that is when it hit the fan. I was relieved to be in AA. I'd known for years I was in AA. And then good friends of mine came into AA. The man I met at Auburn and started dating in 65 and was with until his death in 93. His sobriety date was June the 16th, 79. My closest professional friend, her sobriety date was July 4th, 1977, and she's 12 steps away from Philadelphia, but it didn't take. And another good friend of mine, Mary Beth, who many of you know, her sobriety date was August the 1st, 1980. So I had a lot of friends with me, and then I had a spiritual experience. One night I was getting under, and a voice came to me and said, not self, but soul. Now, I do not necessarily believe in the paranormal, and I was too sober to be hallucinating at that point, but I really believe that it was an awakening. But now let me tell you some of the things that happened. My story is not getting sober, and I really talk too long about that. I get carried away with myself. My story is not getting sober. My story is staying sober. Because let me tell you, the first 6 years that I was sober, let me tell you what happened to me. 1979, Daddy had to have a pacemaker. And at that time, Mother was beginning to have some really weird reactions to things. She hated my Aunt Martha, so she told us that she would hire an armed guard to keep us away from Daddy. Aunt Martha's blood pressure went up. She began to hallucinate freely. Dad had to go stay in the hospital with her. I had to come home. I went to her doctor and said, there's something wrong with Mother. You just got to do something. But here's where alcoholism cost you. He had seen me when the DTs, okay? So I had very little credibility with him, okay? It gets worse. At Christmas, Mother did not do any decorations. I brought presents. She made no move to open them. So I got in my car and went back to Atlanta and found some AA people Christmas Day. Poor Mother, she had really been in love with a man who drank, and she couldn't get him to quit drinking, but Daddy didn't drink. the cruel irony that her only child from that marriage was an alcoholic. It just really tore her up because she feared alcohol above all things. Her father had been a cruel alcoholic. So 1980 had growing professional success. I had two whiplashes within 3 weeks, and I'm in pain to this good day from those whiplashes. Also had to deal in early sobriety with the issue of drugs, and you have to be very responsible for yourself when it comes to taking painkillers or any kind of drug. You talk to your sponsor and take guidance. I don't think I will ever go through an old-fashioned milligram again, taking nothing for pain or nausea, but I think that is probably beyond the call. But nevertheless, that has been an ongoing red flag to me throughout my sobriety. 1981, I got a book contract in May, and in June, my father was diagnosed with cancer. Mother just went berserk. They thought about moving to Magnolia Manor in Americas, and then Mother decided that she would leave him. She left and went and spent 3 weeks with one of her sisters. And I called and told her, I said, now, Mother, if you come back, you're just going to have to settle down. You can't subject Daddy to all this upheaval. And so she and her sister heard a noise during the night while she was down in Camilla, and they boiled out of the house shooting their pistols into the air. All the women in my family carried pistols. All the mother's sisters carried pistols, and of which more later. And Mother left and came home. Daddy, in the meantime, had caught colds and went to the hospital. She wouldn't call the doctor. She called all of her 5 brothers and sisters and treated him with coal tar and salve or something. Here the man was on cold malt and chemo, about to die. And so I called the doctor and got him put in the hospital. No one knew anything about Alzheimer's in those days. This was the early 80s. Alzheimer's was just coming into play. We just thought she was crazy. So anyhow, in 82, Daddy died. But he had told us in the meantime that Mother said, if you come to see Daddy, or if Aunt Martha comes to see him, I will leave and abandon him. So we met, Daddy and I met at a Waffle House at Christmas. And he said, I have lived my life. And you've got a book contract. And you've got to live your life and secure your future. So I didn't see Daddy, said that one time from October 81 to July 82. And see, Mother had a brother who was a very violent alcoholic. And he was the only Mother was the only mother he'd ever known. So he threatened to kill Daddy. See, when Mother could no longer hide the fact that she had a bad memory, said, well, it's because she told him, well, it's because Maxine and Mac have always just abused me terribly. And, of course, the downtrodden, poor relations believed her. And they didn't come after me, but they came after Daddy and Aunt Martha. They put a recorder on the phone so that Daddy couldn't scheme with Aunt Martha to put Mother in a nursing home. And it was just a bad, bad scene all around, let me tell you. So during that period from May 1981 until September 1984, I wrote 2 books. In the meantime, I satisfied one set of requirements to get a promotion in technical writing. Then they changed the standards. So I had to write another book and get another set of requirements to get promotion. You can just go in somebody's file and purge the file of evidence, and there's nobody to say, but you said. So in any case, in 1983, Aunt Martha had cancer, and I stayed with her 5 months while writing a book. 5 months and carried her a round trip to make 96 miles a day, 5 days a week for cobalt. Meantime, Mother would appear at Aunt Martha's door, pistol in hand, and say, where's my deed to my house? And I talked the ears off the people in the Alzheimer's Association. They said, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do but wait and hope that when she bottoms, no one is killed. That's all I could do. So I did not see much, because see, every time I tried to do something for her, she'd call on her brother, and he would be threatening. And her sisters called the bank and said not to talk to me, called the doctor, said not to talk to me. Mother would take her checks out of automatic deposit and take all the money and take it around, lost her car insurance. It was just a zoo, and there's nothing I could do to help her. And I wore AA out. Let me tell you what, in crisis, don't drink and go to meetings. And I can remember, see, I had finally run up against something that I could not change. Before that, I had always been able to weasel myself into and out of things. But all I knew to do was do the next right things. I sent mother's sisters and brothers regular reports on her progress, pictures, so forth and so forth, because I knew they loved and were concerned about her. My cousins, my cousins sided with their mothers, and so I had this group of very angry people on my tail all the time. But I just had to do the right thing. And I remember saying in the meeting at Morningside, and Elizabeth P. will bear this out, that I say again and again, unless I change, my personality will kill me. Unless I change, my personality will kill me. And so I just hung on with my nails, and 6 years after I bottomed on alcohol, I simply collapsed. In 1986, I got a very, very bad allergy thing, and they gave me lots of prednisone. I know now that I must have had prednisone psychosis, hypoglycemic crisis, prednisone psychosis, that sort of thing. But what I did was, I didn't like the effects of the prednisone, so I quit it cold turkey. And nobody knew what was wrong with me. I just couldn't do anything. So I took a quarter off from school. And I was really brought low by that illness. But I went to the Dogwood. Those were the glory days of the Dogwood. I had found a home. I must have gone every day for a year. The dog was sometimes called the dog weird. I loved it. It saved my life. And my family of choice became far more important to me than my family. But the Dogwood also taught me a lesson about transience. All my life had not been very transient. My best friends I knew in college. We were freshmen 50 years ago. Okay, I was rooted in the past, like every Southerner has one foot in the past. So I had to learn transience. I had to learn that this too shall pass. And so it broke my heart when the Dogwood broke up, and I've never really felt quite the same again. But it was there when I needed it. Now I continued to travel. My second book was a great success. I continued to travel and speak. In 1989, Aunt Martha had in 1984, I finally got Mother into Wesley Woods in the Alzheimer's unit. But I tell you, she had led us a merry chase for about 7.5 years. She finally had a bleeding ulcer, and I was able to hospitalize her and get a gerontologist to put her in the home. I had entrusted my finances to a friend during that period of time when I was only in town 90 days in 1983. And I was left with some pretty bad financial troubles, the most important thing being that for the first time I was on my own. I had to suck it up and do what I had to do, and just dig myself out of the hole, get myself out of the hole I had dug for myself. Then in 1985, my Aunt Polly died. She was a sister-in-law, but we had always been responsible for her. And I won my spurs in my little hometown because they didn't fix Aunt Polly's hair right. So she had always worn her hair in curls like Betty Grable. So I went down there in the casket, okay, Aunt Polly. And I fixed her hair. And people are sort of suspicious. People in small towns are suspicious of educated women. Once I fixed Aunt Polly's hair, oh, that Maxine's the smartest thing. You should have seen Miss Polly's hair. So in any case, you just had to do the next right thing. But I tell you, I really had to suck it up and not strike back at Mother's family. One of them called me up and said, I'm gonna get you fired. You whore, you slut. And I said, oh, if I only had the time, energy, and opportunity. So those are some rough years. And I must pay tribute to the late Bob Hatcher. You remember white-haired Bob who used to be at the Stein Club? I dated Bob during those 5 years. I have never had a more steadfast companion than Bob. He was just, he died some years ago, but he was a member of the Dogwood. And of course, throughout those years, throughout my life from 65 to 93, I had an emotional center in Calvin, who was my soulmate and my best friend, and I finally found a perfect match for me. So in any case, now, if anybody needs to leave or scratch or get, anyhow. So, finally got Aunt Martha Wesley Woods in 1989. And at that time I had three houses I was tending in Inman Park, three yards. I had three huge yards I was tending, doing consulting, teaching. And in 1990, Aunt Martha was in the hospital at Wesley Woods, and I told them not to restrain her. They did. She got out of bed and was jerked back from the restraint, broke her neck. And she lived about 3 days. I was so overwhelmed, I just couldn't sue or anything. But I must say that the thing that carried us all through was that little blue book, Acceptance. When Mother could still read and comprehend when she went to the nursing home, she wore out that book, Acceptance. When Aunt Martha had cancer, she wore out that book, Acceptance. And by the way, she survived the cancer, esophageal cancer that she had in 1983. Well, the doctor said, I'm not sure how much medical science has had to do with this cure, but she's cancer-free. So again, the personality and the will can work for your benefit, but it can also just screw you and everybody else around you. So in 1990, December the 7th, I quit smoking. Thereafter, I started spending and eating. But in the meantime, December the, Saturday before New Year's Eve, I drove by El Camino into the parking lot at Georgia Baptist, went in and said, I've got these pains in my chest. And my doctor said, oh, well, it's just indigestion. You just have a hiatal hernia. So finally he agreed to do, at the insistence of a young intern, he did a cardiac catheterization on New Year's Eve, and lo and behold, I was just seconds away from having a heart attack. And I refused the surgery because I had taught 13 members of the championship football team at Tech, and they were playing for the national championship. I said, well, you'll die. You get excited and die. You can watch it if you want to, but you need this operation. So I went. I had the most spiritual awakening. I guess there are no atheists in foxholes and no atheists in on gurneys. But they said you have to have this operation immediately. So I thought, well, I need to do this and this, 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 and this. And I said, well, do I need to make a confession? Do I need to call a priest? Do I need unction? And then I thought, I don't need an intercessor. God loves me. God is with me. It was an overpowering spiritual awakening. And I ceased then, I suppose, to be religious and became spiritual. So in any case, Aunt Martha died, and I had and Daddy's family got mad because I inherited what little she had. I'd looked after her for 20 years. They made us in a Christmas card. In 1993, Calvin died. 1995, Mother died. I continued to travel, have good success, but a new boss came into my life and changed the whole concept of literature. And that was the fight of my life. Finally, they said, Maxine, if you'll just go off and hush, we'll pay you till you're old enough to retire. Your tax dollar at work. So, in any case, I've had to content myself with an occasional letter to the editor of the AJC. But in any case, I retired, and I immediately got into copyright litigation over my recent book. I became association president at a condo and got in a fight with them. Became a president of another organization, got in a fight with them. Became associated president at another condo association, and finally I said, maybe it's not them. Maybe I was not meant to be an executive. And so I have contented myself with a few letters to the editor and travel and so forth. I broke my ankle in 1998, and as a result, I've had two hips replaced, have to have two knees replaced, and I have learned what it is to be helpless and relied on other people, and it has been one of the great lessons of my life. The great spiritual lesson of my life was tending to my mother. She became a very sweet, compliant person. She'd say, oh, you can just do anything. And I thought, is this my mother speaking? And she was very sweet once we got medicated and really. And the 10.5 years that she was in the nursing home with Alzheimer's was a wonderful spiritual experience, as was the years I looked after Aunt Martha. It was time that I grew up, time that I took some responsibility, and time that I reined in my alcoholic personality. Today I'm very happy. I'm more happy and content than I've ever been. I'm more willing to take things day by day. As you know, I'm at the age where I'm thinking ahead about going to nursing home, this, that, and the other. You know, take no thought for tomorrow. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. I have certainly been joyous. I've been very free to do what I wanted to do, except sometimes getting to the kitchen is like an excursion. You have to plan it. But more than anything else, I feel loved. I've never experienced any love like the love I experienced from my friends in AA. Thank you. Thank you.